welcome to another exciting episode of the Global Sales Leader Podcast, where we embark on a journey into the dynamic world of sales and sales leadership, guided by the expert and insights of your host, Jason Cooper. That's me. Prepare to be captivated as we delve into the diverse range of subjects from the sales leadership, psychology and behavior, economics, body language, linguistics, technology, and so much more. And in this episode of the Global Sales Leader Podcast, I interview Dr. Philip Squire, the CEO of Consilia, a sales business school. And we discuss the concept of relationship capitalization. What does that mean? You're going to learn a lot from this episode, which is the idea of measuring the value of customer relationships over time. And that's all about me. I'm the sales relationship coach. So this is all about mutual connections. And I think you're going to love this. So I look forward to listening to more of this. Hello, good morning, good evening, and good afternoon. And wherever you are in this wide, beautiful world, you are very welcome to the Global Sales Leader Podcast. Every time that we come on, we speak to an eclectic array of different types of guests from the air of sales, sales leadership, psychology, behavior, economics, body language, linguistics, technology, and so much more. But I'm always fascinated by speaking to really interesting people. So I've got a really interesting guest today, Dr. Philip Squire. So you are very welcome.
Thank you, Jason. It's a pleasure to be on your podcast. And great to be here.
Yeah, we were speaking just before, and I'm fascinated in this area. And it's a new words that I haven't come across before, which leaves me intrigued. But before we go on to that, a little bit of a bio of Dr. Phil Squire, because the thing that does interest me is the areas that you've done and the doctorate and the research and the stuff that you've done in and around. So your UK-based sales business school that offers sales consulting services and improving sales performance, which is an area that we all are into. And through a notion of sales education, transformation, the vision of sales profession to help the world get better and the most sought after profession. We're all looking for that behavioral shift that can make people be better at what they do. I like to keep it as a human approach, that people skills approach, and uplifting that so you can help people. And I'm going to give it a bit of a Zig Ziglar quote to help others get what they want, because it's all about that client. It's all about the client interaction. And as I always work in relationships, relationship selling, it's always about that longevity with that client to be that number one trusted advisor. So again, you're very welcome. And you also have a company name as well. And I want you to speak about that. And as you hear, if you'd like to quickly introduce yourself, just a quick synopsis of what you do. And
I'm obviously Phil Squire. I'm the CEO of a sales business school, which is called Consilia. And Consilia is a joint venture company created in 2006 by a Spanish, Italian, British company. And the word was invented. We wanted a word that we could register globally without any kind of problems. And so I think it was our Latin partner, Proxy, who actually said, suggested Consilia. So it has a sort of Latin sound to it, but it's consultancy and Alia, all, you know, it worked for us. And so that's where the word Consilia kind of came from. So we have an office in Singapore, which covers our Far Eastern kind of business. And we're headquartered here in the Southwest London, quite close to Heathrow Airport.
Easy to escape and to go to the APAC regions and also the America regions as well. I did notice from your website that you've dealt with some quite big, substantial companies, big tech companies and fintech companies and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So I'm really intrigued because we spoke before, and as I say, we're speaking about relationships, but relationship capitalization, I'm very curious on that. And I know it's part of your book, Transform Selling, but could you give me a little bit more meat to the bones on what that actually is and what that actually means?
Yeah, I suppose the germ of the idea sort of came about speaking to some of my friends and contacts in the M&A world, mergers and acquisition world. Mm-hmm. And they've talked about the challenge that they had when they're valuing a business to put a value on the client base. And I mean, clearly, if you're buying a company, you might be buying it for its different sort of IP assets, mm-hmm. that it has, its products and services, but you're also buying a company because of its track record with customers, consumers, and projections over a period of time. So they were talking about clients specifically, and about how often when company A buys company B, new ownership perhaps takes place, and that you'd sometimes see an erosion of clients happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what that did was kind of it spurred this idea, and it's been a long time kind of shaping in why, you know, we know that customers are really important, and it's arguably the most important asset of any business.
Absolutely.
The only time from an accounting perspective that you would put a value on that, which is represented in it's in the company valuation, is at the point at which a company gets sold.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that you track over time. So it's from a sort of financial aspect. So we know, I know you're a great believer in this as well, that client relationships are so critical.
Yeah, absolutely. Know
it's so. Yeah, so I've kind of been intrigued with the kind of metrics that you might use to kind of measure relationship capital over a period of time. And I mm-hmm. think that when I first started sort of playing with this idea, it's probably about 10 years ago, and the technologies did not exist at the time that can help you measure different aspects of
mm-hmm.
of the levers that go into building up relationship capital. And I would say it's still in embryonic form, this idea, but for sure it is much more, it is possible now to track and give a measure to the capital of relationships such as they exist for clients that we kind of work with. So
mm-hmm.
I think it's an area that may grow as the topic becomes, and the technologies also become more readily available, you know, for us to track relationships in different ways.
There's a thing called return on relationship. And I'm not sure whether you heard of that. The acronym is RORN.
Yeah.
And that was designed and developed by a guy that I know quite well called Ted Rubin.
Right.
And it's another acronym, like OKRs and yes. also the KPRs. It's all another performance metrics. But
yeah,
on return on relationship, yeah, I think there is definitely something there to grow and install within people's minds, because that's where the number one focus actually is how well can we help our clients on that relationship for longevity, but how can we yeah. track those metrics along the way as well, which is really quite interesting, because yeah. we don't want to have the scenario where we're only hitting the customers and for the short term period. We want to see how more effective that we can be in the longevity, and that's where a little bit of consultative selling comes in, managing your accounts well. How is the account for the next 3 years? What number would you put onto that? also the next 5 years, and what do we need to do to be that number one trusted advisor, where meaning that the clients will come to you with their challenges rather than you going out to them with finding out an exploratory way.
The word capitalization is quite an important part of the thinking. So as opposed to relationship capital or return on capital, the word capitalization was really exploring this idea of moving from a metric onto the balance sheet. And I think that we're quite a long way from getting there, but certainly the principles of how it's done could be adopted by selling organizations if they wanted to treat their customers as an asset class in the balance sheet. You know, what would you do? We've come at this particular topic. You know, you could look at the type of contracts you're selling to customers, the longevity of contracts, and the sort of annual recurring revenue metrics that are now used predominantly in the software industry could also be used in non-software related products and services. You've got financial contribution, you know, margin kind of metrics. So you've got a legal dimension, you've got a financial dimension, and then you get this relationship dimension as well, which you could get from sort of measuring either through sort of NPS type scores, but also the area that we're quite interested in measuring is from a sales point of view, how customers perceive salespeople specifically around a number of different values and mindsets. So I think a combination of these three levers could be combined to come up with a relationship sort of capital figure. We don't necessarily, you know, may not want to go into the sort of detail of that in any way, but I think that treating clients as an asset class, you would treat your asset, you know, the way you manage your asset, your way you depreciate your asset, you know, sort of over time, the way that you sort of grow your asset base is, you know, it's very important. And I think that's how we should look at customers. You know, we should view them as an asset that is there to be developed over time. And we should adopt whatever practices we have to kind of building that asset and measure its return, like you said earlier, as well as we can.
You mentioned there as well, because I'm fascinated by what you've said about this, because this is a new field, a new area. But I know in your book, we discussed about the values and mindsets behind the people that are actually doing the connection with the clients and utilizing people, clients, the customer as an asset. But in order for that to happen, we need to make sure that our people have the right tools enabled within them to actually engage within all of the areas to get up to relationship capitalization. So if we look backwards, what do we need to do in order for that to happen, to get the right values and the mindset installed within them so that they can genuinely and professionally and organically communicate effectively on a one-to-one level with your people skills? And I'm a big advocate on your organic people skills, because it's a massive thing within the sales profession, which I'm not sure with AI and all that might get a little bit lost, but I think that's another conversation as well.
Probably is, but I mean the research that I did was based on a study that I'd done with a number of our global accounts where they asked us to go and interview their customers about how their customers wanted to be sold to. And what was very interesting as the data was collected was the looking at the data through different lenses. So I'd been brought up in a world of what I called more more traditional sort of sales approaches, which is based around behavior, mainly around different behavioral change. And I remember after a couple of years of looking at, you know, literally I went around the world interviewing many, many different customers in different functions and at different levels. So looking at the data through the, what I would call this sort of traditional lens of behavior, and not coming up with anything new, because, you know, the data suggested that we need to become, you know, very skilled at asking questions, at listening and body language and emotional, you know, looking at emotional intelligence and these kind of things. And I felt that and by that time I'd taken this research and pulled it into a structured doctorate research program, because I wanted the research to be robust in terms of looking at properly reflecting on the data. And it was quite a low point in you know, after a couple of years of doing all these kind of research interviews. By the way, my customers were, our customers were also really interested in in what I was doing, obviously. But then I was on a particular module of the university about research techniques, and one of the questions I was asked was about my values and belief systems, and I was asked what they were, to define them, and I remember sort of coming out with a load of the, you know, typical ones like being honest and acting with integrity and family orientated, whatever they were. And of course the lecturer saw right through this and said, Phil, you haven't really thought about it, and she was right. I hadn't thought about it, and I realized that the lens through which we see the world and which we see data is influenced by our values and belief systems. So the first thing I should do is focus on what mine were. But what this did was it made me go back to the interview data and look at it in a different way. And my questions were, first of all, listening to direct quotes that customers were saying, but also looking at behavior that they liked and didn't like, but seeing it through the lens of values and belief systems. And on the basis that if you have a certain set of values and belief systems that were right, that should drive the kind of behavior. And I'd realized for much of my career in sales, I'd been focusing on, you know, sales techniques or different skills and competencies that were very much like, you know, sort of more surface related, more behavioral related techniques. And I began to really look at the data and define what were the values that customers talked about, which they didn't like, and what were the values that they did like. And the hypothesis that then slowly emerged from that was that if it were possible to define the values that customers really wanted, and you then were able to take a sales team and teach them those values, and they then embedded those values as part of their sales operating system, would that then drive the behavior that would then drive the results? And the second half of my doctorate was doing just that with different control groups of salespeople, comparing performance, and that led us to defining the four critical mindsets for sales success, and the four negative mindsets that customers often saw.
So, I mean, tell me the difference between the two, because I'm all to do with your intrinsic motivation, stuff that goes on behind the scenes, behind the brains, but also the decision making, extrinsic, intrinsic motivations from the customer's point of view. But I want to see your four areas, because I want to shortcut where you are going, and I'd love to hear the four positive things of what you've seen.
Okay,
and look at the negative things, because I think this would be really interesting for the listeners out here to just to see the difference and play with the two of them and see what the outcomes were as well from your point of view.
Well, it was fascinating. I mean, when I sort of asked the question also maybe about what percentage of salespeople lived the values that customers wanted, the figure was very low. It's sort of 80% of people I interviewed, and I interviewed just under 100 people as mm-hmm. part of the doctorate, 80% of people said less than 10% of salespeople sold in the way that they really wanted. So let's cut to the chase and sort of look at, you know, the positive mindsets. Two of them will come as a kind of not a particular surprise. So the first one was around authenticity.
Yep.
And it takes a long time to come up with the word, you know, these words. You know, is it transparency? Is it integrity? Is it? But I was interested in authenticity because you've got this sense of being the author of something, the original. So part of the word authenticity captures this essence of originality of thought.
Yeah.
As well as being acting with integrity. You know, it's a bit like your authentic Levi jeans was the first one, you know, if you go back to that ad. The second was client centricity, you know, mm-hmm. being totally focused on the client. And then the following two were the ones that really differentiated the great salespeople from the not great, were proactive creativity and tactful audacity.
Mm-hmm.
So proactive creativity is, you know, as the word suggests, it's coming up with ideas before customers have necessarily come up with the idea.
Mm-hmm.
Could be a fresh bit of insight that you want to share with the customer about something, or it may be you knowing the customer that well that you can see how they could improve things that they haven't seen yet. But tactful audacity is the art of knowing how far to go without going too far, and this is about being bold and being challenging as well, and that takes quite a lot of courage. So those are the four positive mindsets.
Question I wanted to jump in there actually before you go in there. From the stuff that I've looked into, a lot of the stuff is it's being yourself as well, but also understanding yourself. The more you understand yourself and who you are, I think you have a better mindset to actually help other people to get what they want, because you have a greater understanding of yourself. But you can also have a look and work out other people in a better way. But I did stop you there, and I want you to jump onto next point as well.
No, I totally agree, because when you start going on this journey about values and belief systems, you've really got to get down to the individual, you know, and so, you know, we do that by taking people through a process of defining them. And you can do it in, broadly speaking, two ways. One is you can ask people to choose from, you know, maybe 100 different potential values, the ones that mm-hmm. they mostly connect with. And you can, you know, there's simple exercises, you can do that fairly quickly. The other way, which is more in depth, is where you can get people, you can teach people how to critically reflect, first of all. Mm-hmm. But secondly, you can get them to look at pivotal moments that have happened in their life and to explore how they felt when it happened and how they behaved, and then get them to discuss then what does that tell them about their values and belief mm-hmm. systems. Because it's often in those pivotal moments that you begin to really surface what they are. So this could have been losing a big deal, or it could be a discussion with a manager that you've had, or which had a major impact on you. So part of what we do to get people to better understand who they are and what their values and beliefs are is to deeply question what their values and beliefs are. And that's really the starting point. And then you can contrast that with the values that customers want. And mm-hmm. you can then start to make connections between your personal value system and those that customers want. And then it begs the question, is it possible to adopt values, or are you born with them? And of course, we learn, we're not born with values. We may have a personality that looks remarkably similar from when we're an infant up to older, but values are definitely things that can be shaped based on experience and knowledge and learning. And certainly belief systems are the same. So the great thing about values is its predictability, because when you know, let's imagine you've got the culture of a sales team, when you know what that culture is, and if you know, and if that culture is built upon, for example, the four mindsets, we know that the predictability of the salesperson is likely to be one of, you know, conducting thorough research, doing the due diligence, not trying to manipulate the customer with sales techniques that may have been taught on previous training programs. That they are going to be themselves. And we would anticipate that they will be thinking ahead of the customer. They will be challenging the customer, because it's really going into the sort of DNA of how people think.
And I'm always curious, because it's great and wonderful to jump into your own belief systems and think about that. But what has to happen after that? Because we know that if things need to change, you have to go internally to bring everything out, to change a habit or change a thought or change a process. Could take 3 weeks, it could take 3 months, depending on the research that you look into. 21 days to start a different way of habit, and then up to 66 days to install that habit.
Yeah. But
within your process, what things need to happen in order to make those significant changes within inside a person?
Yeah. I mean, it's a really great question, because there's this concept of values and then lived values. And you're really talking about lived values here. And I think it's really important, because anyone can spout out, you know, different words, but at the end of the day, you want to see it lived.
Yep.
It can take time. And also, you come back to this growth versus fixed mindset. You know, if you've got someone who's got a fixed mindset, the chances are that they're never going to shift. If they've got a growth mindset and they're open to the idea of learning, then absolutely you're in fertile ground, and it's amazing what you can do. I mean, one of the, you know, to quicken the process, if you like, of getting individuals to realize its importance is actually hearing it from the customer first. And what we found is often with the kind of way that we engage with our customers is we start with their customers first and work backwards, and you know, hearing customers talking about values and belief systems that they want salespeople to have.
I'm curious to listen to find out a lot more about that side of it, because it's fair enough for the salesperson, but really the customer is the most important person within that process.
We sometimes get challenged because we've got so much data and research, you know, that's been developed sort of over the years on this topic, and then people come and say, well, actually, but our business is a bit different, you know. Whatever. So we said, well, why don't we go and interview some of your customers? A couple of things on this. This is not about how good the service is, you know, which is generally done with NPS type scoring. This is actually about salesmanship. And so that's all that we do. We just focus on selling. And hearing your customers talk in the language of the values and beliefs that I've just described, it then becomes a kind of no-brainer, because it, you know, no salesperson is going to listen, you know, hear a customer say, this is how I want to be sold to, and say, oh, that's rubbish. You know, they won't say that. So so we're constantly going out, redoing the research, often, you know, across many different types of sectors in order to provide an easier route for salespeople to accept that actually these values are important.
Mm.
And also, you know, it's interesting that we've had instances where we've interviewed customers of our customer, and, you know, obviously the salesperson whose customer it is that you've interviewed will listen and watch the video and listen to the audio, whatever it is. And they will find it a really useful tool to then go back to the customer and say, well, I understand that proactive creativity, or, you know, we don't challenge you enough. How do we fix that? How can I fix that with you? So it becomes then a conversation that salesperson can then take to their customer. And quite often you find doors are unlocked because they've been very short-sighted about how they thought they were doing a great job, but customers are often very perceptive about values and beliefs. It matters more to them than technique.
Yeah, I totally agree, because people can see through a technique. They can see the feel, felt, found method and all of that stuff, which is aged old. Everyone knows about it. But really, it's listening to understand what the customer actually does want and what their belief values are actually, and how they love to be sold to. Because they can see through all of the techniques and this, that, and the other, which is probably installed into a lot of major corporations around the world, which I've seen.
Yeah.
And it really, I think maybe that's a starting thing, but then you have to adapt it to your own style and creativity around that.
Yeah.
Because I've found some of the most incredible salespeople out there are the ones that are more self-accountable for their own actions.
Yes.
But also to learn and to feed forward. And what I mean by feeding forward is to listen, to understand and go, well, what do I need to do now to change and adapt to what the client actually does want?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's a really important, that sort of agility of thinking is what clients also want, because they need you to be creative, to be a great problem solver. And having salespeople who come in with a very supplier-centric kind of approach to the way they sell is, you know, they can spot that from a mile away. And they become suspicious of the questions. And, you know, is the salesperson really listening to what I'm trying to say, or are they just trying to manipulate my conversation into something that can help them? You know, they pick these signals up very astutely, and that's why they look for values in salespeople. If they believe in the values of the salesperson, they will coach that salesperson, they will develop them so that it will benefit their own companies. I could talk a lot on this topic.
I love it. I'm completely bought into it, because it's an area that I'm number one fascinated in.
Yeah.
But I've also done I've been speaking to thousands of people on similar subjects. And as I said to you before, recently did a whole course on decision making and understanding that, because it's all to do with the client and customers as well.
Yes.
And it's deciding whether they want to buy to you.
Yeah,
because you're the person, you're the person of the company, you're the face of the company, because I'm speaking to you.
Correct.
And I approach to that customer, and the client and the customer has to make their decision, and that rest decision, do I want to carry on further with that person? Do they cover the trusting areas? Are they generally interested in me and problem solving and being creative around understanding a little bit more about their operations or whatever it might be to do with that client, and getting towards an air of, and again, I will come to being a trusted advisor. They can actually call you eventually at some stage because they covered all of the values and beliefs that they're going through their minds when they're actually speaking to them. So that's a real fascination.
Well, it's interesting. So I do have a thought about this term trusted advisor, which is that if you take the four positive mindsets I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. sort of authenticity and client centricity, and you tick those boxes from the customer's point of view, you have a very much a trusted relationship, you know, yeah. because they 100% see you as being authentic. You really do know their business. But the proactive creativity and tactful audacity takes you into another level of trust. And so that, you know, a lot of salespeople think, well, I got great relationships with my customers.
Yeah.
And probably they do. They probably are authentic, or they probably are client-centric in what they mm-hmm. do. But if they don't demonstrate to the extent that customers want the proactive creativity and tactful audacity, then they won't get into that trusted advisor status. I think the word proactive is important, because a trusted advisor could be someone that you go to when you've got a problem and you want it fixed. That's where a lot of people and a lot of salespeople may tick the creativity box. And so, yes, I've got a problem. I come to you to fix it. Mm-hmm. But the proactive creativity and tactful audacity, I think, takes that concept to another level.
And what do you think about this? And sorry to stop you in the moment.
Yeah, no.
Because I think it's also the collaborative approach as well. Like both in
collaborative,
the same reason. And I think that might be, I'm not sure where, if you were going to go there as well, but
no,
because once you're both invested within that, they can actually help within solving the issue as well as yourself, and you're both working on the same challenge at the same time. And that's when that sparks different ideas about going inside the box, outside the box, wherever you want to be going to solve it in a creative solution that helps both parties. So it's a win-win solution for all people.
Yeah. So when we were sort of developing these four positive mindsets, we went through a big process of whiteboarding all of the different words and connections. Mm. Collaboration sat as a fifth value. But we then said, because simplicity of a message is important, and we then said, well, should it fit under client centricity as a subword, if you like? So against each one of these mindsets, if you sort of look at the book, for example, it describes clusters of words associated, and collaboration is very much mentioned. Mm-hmm. And we felt that if you were truly client-centric, and say your customer had a problem that you could 90% solve, but 10% couldn't, but the 10% could come from, say, another partner, then you would look at this collaboration. You know, you would say to a customer, well, I can 90% of it we can solve, but actually we think by collaborating with another partner, we can together get you the 100% that would be the right fix. So we look at collaboration from a client side. You're quite right, this joint creative problem solving process. Also on the supply side, not just being preoccupied with only selling your products and services, but looking at how combinations of products and services together could mm-hmm. potentially bring a better solution to your customer, because you're completely driven by what's going to create most value for your customer. So collaboration and co-creation are just massively important skills. And I totally agree with you that
some of the research that I've done behind the decision making is, like, we know our brain, if we get overwhelmed by too much information, if thrown at the person or the people, you get overwhelmed, you get decision overwhelm and fatigue. And we know that when we go to IKEA, as an example, we get overwhelmed and we get confused. So as you said, the four parts, keeping things quite simple and straight down to a process, but also the decision making within the client's eyes is, am I making things really easy for them to understand? Am I not overwhelming the neocortex, going straight towards the limbic system where the emotions actually are? Are we keeping things really straight to the point? But yeah. Also, our decision-making process is quite easy to understand, that we can just get it straight away from both parties, from the salesperson perspective, to keep it really simple. But from the decision-making process of the buyer, they understand it straight away from what's being communicated. Yeah. So whether that's another value belief, I know we could probably go on and on and on with lots of different values, but I know we want to keep it quite simple for the customer's eyes, and especially for the buyer as well.
Yeah. No, I think what you said about sort of simplicity of messaging is important. It's hugely important. But again, if you are driven from the value of client centricity, then part of that is enabling the client to make decisions. Mm. Yeah. So, in order to help your client deal with the ubiquitous nature of information, then the messaging of your story is terribly important. So you can make it easier for them, A, to understand your value proposition, but B, take that internally into their own organization and articulate the why supplier X choice. Yeah. So again, it depends whether you want to separate some of these words like simplicity as a value, or whether you put it under something else.
Yeah.
And so we've chosen, for simplicity's sake, to try and keep to these four. And then underneath the four, there's a whole strata of other words, you know, that then follow, that kind of lead you to that point where you're being totally client-centric.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can forever play with words and come up with new ways of doing things. But we sort of kept it to the four, and it holds us in quite good stead. But
and it keeps you conditioned and it keeps you focused, so you can see the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
So you have a book called Selling Transformed.
Yes.
I'm actually assuming that's available on all the platforms out there, Amazon's and so on and so forth. And I'll have to add that to my bucket list of books.
I can see your impressive books behind you. So, yeah.
But that doesn't include the digital books, because I go through a couple of those a month as well.
I do. So okay.
I'm an avid reader. So I will definitely add your book onto it. And how can people find out more about you?
Well, obviously, our website is there at www.consalia.com, which you can see. We also have a sales transformation podcast, so people can tune into us there. And we have quite a strong LinkedIn presence as well. So, we're pretty available. If people are interested in undergraduate degree courses for salespeople, they can find us on government websites and so on. So we're quite, they should find it easier to find us if they want to.
Awesome. You also have a assessment of degree.
We have the Mindset Survey. It's a free survey tool. Mm-hmm. Just 20 questions that have been sort of designed over many years, but can give you an idea of how you see yourself as an individual against the four positive mindsets and also the four negative mindsets. And you can also invite your customers to give their feedback. So it's like a 180 tool. It's at www.consalia.com/mindset. I think it is. I'm looking at Eddie. Mindset survey. Right. they can do that as well. So awesome. You can go quite a long way if you're intrigued with this notion to test it yourself and also get your clients to give you feedback as well.
Awesome stuff. Well, thank you so much. It's been really a fascinating
thank you, Jason.
Podcast today. And I'm genuinely interested because I like to find and speak to people that can stimulate different parts of my brain and go, I'm fascinated with that. And it comes across because all I want to do is within these conversations is feed forward and air of some golden nuggets that if people are listening, they can go, well, I'm going to help and I'm going to apply that to whatever I do within sales, sales leadership, and create that ripple effect. So that's what I hope we have achieved today, and I'm pretty certain we have. And great. I'm looking forward to maybe discussing further at a later stage. So thank you once again.
Pleasure. Thank you, Jason. It's been a pleasure to be on your program. Thank you. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to the Global Sales Leader podcast, I'm your host, Jason Cooper from jasoncooper.io. Every time or every week, you can hear some eclectic array of some incredible, interesting people. So thank you once again. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Global Sales Leader podcast. I'm your host, Jason Cooper. You can find out a lot more from me and about me at jasoncooper.io. I look and help develop individuals and teams to make sure they enhance all of their core people skills. Now, I like to say people skills rather than sales techniques and all of that, but it is people skills. How can you communicate more effectively and help your customers get more of what they want? And obviously, I do this podcast, which I love. So find out more from jasoncooper.io.